supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. 2 months after two black men were arrested at a Center City Starbucks, the Philadelphia Police Department has a new policy for handling calls for so-called defiant trespassing, the crime at the call of that vital incident. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, experts are cautiously optimistic it will spur positive change.
The policy tells officers what to do when they're responding to a trespassing call at any private business open to the public. Cops still have a fair amount of discretion, but there's a number of things that have to happen before someone can be arrested and taken into custody. Captain Sekou Kinnebrew says the first step is de-escalation.
If it requires you to say, hey, listen, why don't you come over to this side and you come to that side, that might be what it is. If it's blow a whistle, that might be what it is.
Before making an arrest, officers have to witness a person refusing to leave. They also need to get approval from their supervisor, and the store owner or manager must sign paperwork saying they want to press charges. Philip Stinson studies criminology at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He says the policy is promising, but
it's very difficult to change officers' habits, the way that they handle situations. There would need to be ongoing training and constant reminders that we want to encourage officers to de-escalate situations. The more difficult that somebody on the street presents themselves to an officer, the more likely it is that they're going to get arrested.
Asa Khalif leads Black Lives Matter Pennsylvania, one of the groups that staged protests at the Starbucks in Rittenhouse Square after two black men were arrested for refusing to make a purchase or leave. With or without training, he says the policy won't make life easier for African Americans.
It looks good on paper, and it seems that it gives police more room to make fewer arrests. But the fact remains is when police are in contact with black and brown bodies, discretion is never something that's on a positive end for us.
The police department says it's reviewing its implicit bias training to see if there are any ways to improve. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Budget negotiations continue at Philadelphia City Hall as Mayor Jim Kenney and City Council fight over the best way to boost revenue following a request by the school district. This week, City Councilwoman Helen Gim introduced legislation she says would provide an alternative. It's described as a middle ground that raises the same amount of money that the mayor wants while avoiding property tax hikes that council loathes. Jake Blumgard of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Mayor Kenney's budget this year asked Philadelphians to accept a property tax hike as part of a plan to bring in an added $770 million. But City Council offered an alternative budget proposal without the property tax increase. The City Finance Director Rob Dubose says that plan falls well short of what's needed and includes estimates that cannot be relied on.
We just don't think that the amount of revenues it would generate is supportable enough to put in our budget and plan.
Based on Dubose's reading, the council plan will leave the school district unable to do badly needed repairs on some of its schools, which suffer from mold, lead, and asbestos. Councilwoman Helen Gim says she has a middle path.
But I remain deeply concerned about the long-term financial stability of the school district, and especially about our ability to make any headway around the dangerous and inhumane conditions that exist within our school's facilities.
Gim's proposal would avoid a property tax increase by instead taking from city coffers to give the school district a larger share of the money that's already being raised. That idea would leave a huge hole in the city budget. So to fix that, she would raise business taxes, which many civic leaders have fought for decades to lower because of their negative effect on economic growth. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
This week, Republican gubernatorial candidate Scott Wagner focused some of his energy on an unlikely target, grass, specifically the lawn of a park in West Philadelphia. Wagner very publicly paid to have it cut after noticing it was overgrown. What does Wagner care about Philly beautification? Katie Meyer has more on that and about the feathers he may have ruffled along the way.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. I'm in Malcolm X Park, Wagner discovered Philadelphia's Malcolm X Park at a campaign event just a couple days after he resigned from his position as a York County senator to focus on his gubernatorial bid. Upon seeing what he calls a disgusting park strewn with trash, he got on Facebook Live.
I mean, I'm shocked. Grass hasn't been mowed here for weeks. We're in a, I think, could be a, what could be a beautiful park.
He gave Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney an ultimatum. Clean up the park within 4 days, or Wagner would return with a mower and crew to do the job himself. That was Saturday. The city started cutting the grass Monday. A spokesman for the mayor says it was scheduled maintenance. But 2 days after that, Wagner was back in Philly and back on Facebook.
Well, I'm here. It's Wednesday morning, and there have been some mowing has taken place. But I can tell you what I've seen so far is pretty disgusting.
The former state senator says when he and four contract workers he employs at his trash company got to the park that day, two city employees were already there cleaning up. He sent them packing.
I mean, it was impossible. And then I walked over to the mower, and the mower was like probably, it looked like something was 25 years old. So I just told the guys, we're going to mow this. I said, you guys just don't have good equipment.
The mayor's office contests a lot of this. Spokesman Mike Dunn says city workers cleaned up almost all the park through Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday because they had to work around families who were using it. He maintains their equipment was fine and criticized Wagner for putting employees in a very awkward situation by asking them to leave for what he calls a publicity stunt.
When I first got to Harrisburg,
Wagner's a proud fiscal conservative, one who has repeatedly criticized Governor Tom Wolf for spending carelessly.
Pennsylvania does not have a revenue problem and has a spending and mismanagement problem.
He says all told, the park cleanup took about 7 hours, not counting what the city had already done, and involved his team making the more than two-hour journey from York to Philly and back. But asked whether that's a waste of time, he's indignant.
No, it wasn't, because it was a complete half-assed job. I would be ashamed. If I was Mayor Kenney, you'd have to see the mow job they did. They should be ashamed. No, it wasn't a waste of time.
There's also, it might seem incredible, a policy component to this. In their pointed comment, the mayor's office said Philadelphia's contentious beverage tax, which Wagner opposes, is intended in part to create more money for city parks. Wagner's response?
The money's flowing in. What I want to know is what are they doing with the money before we give them more money? We may find out that they're getting more money than they need.
Dunn says specifically $2 million annual dollars from the tax have been slated for 40 new positions in the Parks and Recreation Department, which would be the key improvement. But back to Malcolm X Park itself. Gregory Spearman, the 60th ward leader who represents the park and surrounding neighborhoods, says the whole thing hasn't been high on his priority list.
Oh, I live down the street. The park is usually okay.
At the end of the day, he says he's not one to turn down a free lawn mowing. And though he's a little suspicious of Wagner's political ends,
I do have an issue with people bringing notice to it. It starts to make me think, well, what is your motive?
He notes it's a rare thing for a Republican to even be in West Philly.
Republicans, I haven't seen a Republican initiative, period.
As for Wagner, he says he hopes this sets a tone for the rest of his campaign.
I did it. It's something I did, and that's the kind of guy I'm. I just said I was going to do it, and I did it, and it's done right, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the people that helped.
Wagner will face off against incumbent Democrat Tom Wolf in November. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
This weekend, the second half of a 24-hour performance takes place at the Merriam Theater in Philadelphia. The first 12 hours of a 24-decade history of popular music were performed last weekend. Then the next 12 will be on Saturday. The show traces the legacy of music to foster social and political resistance. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the traveling show picks up local performers in every city it goes to.
Taylor Mack believes in endurance, both for himself and his audiences. He has performed his 24-hour show before nonstop, each hour representing one decade of American history. He's taking it easier in Philadelphia, but not by much. Audiences are expected to attend two 12-hour performances a week apart.
One of your jobs as a theater artist is to break people's defenses down so that they can be open to the experience.
Max says he's using the 12-hour marathon shows to fundamentally change how audience members experience theater and themselves. And it takes more than the typical 90 minutes to break them down.
What I've found is that the audience gets kind of deranged in their emotional availability. And it's really beautiful to see that.
The production is as big as it is long, with a large band, about 100 guest performers, dozens of costume changes, and 240 songs, all of them memorized with no teleprompter. Taylor Mack is the center of it all.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
The songs, their narrative of social uprising, and the incredible length of a 24-decade history of popular music is intended to be more than a theatrical stunt. Max says he's looking to turn his audience into a community.
I went to the very first AIDS walk in the United States when I was 14. I'd never met an out homosexual before. First time I ever saw any out homosexuals in my life, it was thousands all at the same time. The reason they were all together is because of the epidemic. So because the epidemic is tearing them apart, they're all gathered. And that kind of stayed with me as I went through my life. And I thought, I want to make a show that's a metaphorical representation of that, how we are building ourselves time and time again because of difficult circumstances, because we're being torn apart.
The show incorporates many Philadelphia performers. Much of his band are local pickup musicians, and he has many special guests, including a 40-member drill squad from Camden, the Sophisticated Sisters, and a Mexican woman playing a tiny guitar. This is the jarana, sort of like a Mexican ukulele, but with 8 strings. It's particular to Son Jarocho. That's a folk music native to the Veracruz region of Mexico.
One really powerful thing about this music in the United States, it's been able to focus in on the immigrant experience in the U.S.
This is Yared Portillo, who uses the jarana as part of her activism.
It's become a music that's been able to be used to talk about these experiences and to challenge political ideas. So it's become a music of resistance and of political activism.
When Portillo was approached to play a small part in Taylor Mack's massive theatrical project, she was hesitant. For one thing, she's never played in a theater before. Portillo says Son Jarocho is a music that's not supposed to be played on stage for an audience, but rather designed to be played at a fandango. It's a kind of informal music party among friends.
It would be, let's say, a Saturday night. We have something to celebrate. Someone just graduated. Someone had a birthday. It's El Día de la Virgen. Something special is going on. Or sometimes we just want a reason to come together. We put a tarima on the floor. It's a little raised wooden platform where people tap dance. We make a whole bunch of food. We all gather around the tarima. And we just start playing. We start singing. It can go until hours of the morning. Por esta nación. So when this opportunity came up, you know, I think the question was, how do I do this while honoring the tradition, while honoring the people who have taught me this and not turning it into just a stage performance?
Portillo did not want to be the Latina accent to Taylor Mack's grandiose spectacle. After talking with him over the phone, she decided that they actually share a common goal, to build community.
A lot of what he's doing had these elements of what felt like the fandango. He's going and going and pushing people through and continuing to sing.
And like the fandango, there is food. Taylor Mack has audience comfort in mind during a 24-decade history of popular music, offering moments to get up, move around, talk to each other, and share a meal. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Donald Trump's status as a wealthy businessman helped him gain a base in the 2016 presidential election. But where does he stand in the court of public opinion now? NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, about the president's approval rating and how Americans feel about the rich in general. The conversation began with the big question, who wants to be a millionaire?
Frank, more specifically, I understand Gallup asked, would you personally want to be rich?
Yes, that's absolutely the question that we've asked. We've actually been asking that for a while now, back to 1990, and the numbers have really not changed. But let me give you the answer. 61% of Americans who are not rich now, and by the way, only 1% of Americans say they're rich now, so that's not very many that we excluded. 61% of us say that, yes, everything else being equal, we would be happy to be rich. Back in 1990, low those many years ago, it was 59%. In 1996, it was 60%. Then it was 63%. Back in 2012, but basically hasn't changed much at all. Fundamentally, 6 in 10 of us say, sure, we would like to be rich if we could.
And for the rest, do they want to be a little less than rich?
Well, we don't ask exactly how much money you would like to have other than, quote, being rich. And we don't define rich either. We just say, would you like to be rich? So that's the answer we get.
What percent think that wealth is a key to fulfillment or happiness?
Not as many as you might think. You've seen those studies, Dave, I assume, which show that people who win the lottery actually end up being unhappy, right? Because all their relatives come out of the woodwork and ask for money and those types of things. Well, we ask Americans, are rich people happier than you, less happy, or about the same? And we may be reducing dissonance, but 56% say about the same. But 28% of us say those rich people are less happy than we are. And only 12% say that they are happier.
Given so much news on the widening gulf between the haves and have-nots, what do Americans in general think about an increasingly wealthy class?
That's an important question that we have updated several times. I think it's very important because clearly, as you say, Dave, there's been much more discussion recently about inequality, about the 1% about having a lot of rich people, but a lot of people are certainly not well off at all. But still, 58%, that's the core number. 58% of Americans in our survey we just finished here at Gallup say, yes, the United States does, in fact, benefit from having a class of rich people. That's down slightly from when we asked it in 2012, mainly because Democrats have become less likely to say yes, but about the same roughly as we found back in 1990.
As you mentioned, Democrats, how wide is the partisan gulf?
Huge. 81% of Republicans say yes, a rich class is good for this country. Just 43% of Democrats agree. So the majority of Democrats say it's not good to have a rich class, and overwhelmingly Republicans say it is. But you know, Dave, I want to point out vis-a-vis what we talked about just a minute ago, that even Democrats who tell us, no, having a class of rich people is not good for the country, themselves say, at least a slight majority, well, I'd like to be rich if I could.
More on Democrats and Republicans with the midterms ahead. How strongly does each party identify or not with the current president, Donald Trump?
Just remarkable. We just did an analysis, actually, for Time magazine. We went back to look at all of our data, and they put it out, and we found that it is as high, basically, as it has been in terms of Republicans saying that they approve of Donald Trump, with one exception, and that was Republicans' approval of George W. Bush right after 9/11, when 98% of Republicans approved. But 87% of Republicans in Trump's 500th day in office say they approve of Donald Trump, and we went back and looked. That's higher than was the case for George H.W. Bush, for JFK, for LBJ, for any of the previous presidents. So even though his overall approval rating is not great, about 41%, even as we speak now, Dave, Republicans, his base, as it is commonly called, really like the guy.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Schools around the Delaware Valley begin summer break now, but not before the tried-and-true tradition of the end-of-the-year student talent show. For some children, it's a chance to allow their budding talents to emerge for all to see. But for Emma Hitchcock, not so much. She shared her talent show gone wrong story at a recent first-person art story slam for WHYY's Common Space.
When I was in fourth grade, we moved from Vermont to right outside of D.C. So I went from a tiny school to like a cast of thousands, all of whom ignored me. So I had no friends because I was the new kid. And right after we got there, the school held a talent show. So I tried to think of something really cool to sing, and so I thought of my paragon of coolness, which was my brother, who's 4 years older than me. He was in eighth grade. Clearly that qualifies as cool. And he was into just the most bitchin' stuff, like Dungeons and Dragons and Tolkien. So he and I had watched the 1970s cartoon version of The Hobbit like 1,000 times. And I decided I was going to sing the theme song to that movie, which is called The Greatest Adventure. And it's a beautiful song. It's all about like seizing the day and taking your moment. But it's a bit of a stretch for an 8-year-old girl. But that's my pick. And I tell my mom, and she's like, I'm going to make you a costume. No. She's like, yeah, it's The Hobbit and Gandalf's in it, so I'll make you a wizard costume. And you'll be just like Gandalf. And I was like, okay. So she proceeds to make me what I can only describe as Liberace Goes Middle Earth. It's bright blue, it's covered in stars and planets and f***ing glitter. And my brother sees it, and rather than laughing at me, goes, you need a shield. So he makes me this cardboard shield, and he writes on it in runes, the elvish language that Tolkien made. Authentic. And I'm standing in front of the mirror before I have to go to this thing, and I'm like, oh, God. I guess this is what we're doing, because who needs friends, you know? So I get there, and they line us up in little foldy chairs at the front of the auditorium. And then right before me is Sarah Lyon, and she was blonde and blue-eyed and perfect, and she got straight A's, and everybody loved her. And she gets up and does this heinously good gymnastic dance routine to The Rhythm Is Gonna Get You. And the crowd loses it. They're like, Sarah, we love you! And there's like lighters, and then it's my turn. And I'm like waddling up to the stage, and I'm like, I have to
copy.
Do this. And it's 3 minutes, and it can't get worse than this, so all right. And I get up on stage, and I was wrong. Because I start singing, and I'm like, the greatest adventure, and the music stops. Like, my tape just cuts out. So now we're in Fellini territory, because all the audience sees is an 8-year-old in a glitter wizard costume a cappella singing a song they have never heard that makes no reference to wizards or Middle Earth or Liberace. There's nothing there. And when it mercifully ends, there's just silence. And then this confused smattering of applause, like, what the f***? And when the whole thing is over, everyone else's parents come running up and they're like, good job, sweetie, you were so good. And my parents are nowhere to be found. So I like wade through the sea of enthused parents to find mine at the very back of the auditorium, right next to the exit, with nothing but disappointment on their faces. And I feel terrible because I'm like, I have let these people down. And my fear is solidified when I walk up and the only thing they say to me is, do you want to go get ice cream? Yes. But I realize now it wasn't like consolation ice cream. It was atonement ice cream. Because their disappointment had nothing to do with me. It was, they felt bad as parents. But it's okay. I know it came from a place of love, and I totally forgive them, because I learned something at 8 that most people never learn, which is that in a do-or-die situation, it is entirely possible to do both at the same time.
Emma Hitchcock is a graphic designer, multimedia artist, and writer in the Philadelphia area. Be sure to check out Season 2 of Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, which airs weekly here, Sunday nights at 8. You can also listen online at Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. News Director Eugene Son, Assistant News Director Katie Culinary, John Musoni, Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our engineers this week, Al Bank, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.